The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
I had only one Sergio, Kofi Annan remarked, in the aftermath of the 2003 car bombing at the Canal Hotel in Baghdad, in which Sergio Vieira de Mello, the UN Secretary General's special envoy, perished. What Annan meant, Samantha Power writes in the epilogue to her beautiful and passionate biography, was that he knew nobody who had had Vieira de Mello's linguistic skills, cultural breadth, critical mind, political savvy, humanitarian commitments, and world-weary wisdom. Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World is Power's portrait of a man whose skills the world desperately needed and still needs today. Over his many years of UN service in epicenters of world conflict like Lebanon, Bosnia, Rwanda, and East Timor, Vieira de Mello came to see half of his job, writes Power, as expectation management. He was a pragmatist. Reading about Vieira de Mello's tragic and disturbing death in the rubble of the UN building is agonizing. Reading about the development of his principled, flexible pragmatism is exhilarating. Described as a cross between Bobby Kennedy and James Bond, Vieira de Mello evolved into a seasoned UN diplomat and politician, exceptionally skilled at brokering peace in distant, war-ravaged countries. He served, as I said, all over the world. He was the kind of man who refused to wear a flak jacket in Sarajevo because the Sarajevans themselves had no such protection, who helped to find the nephew of the Kosovar cleaning lady at UN headquarters in New York. He was a remarkable person, and tonight you will learn about this great humanitarian whose life yields vital lessons for us today. Samantha Power is the Anna Lind Professor of Global Leadership and Public Policy Practice at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. She is a Red Sox fan and a damn good basketball player. She is serving as foreign policy advisor to the campaign of Senator Barack Obama. Good sign. Her 2003 book, A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award, among other honors. We're very pleased to have in conversation with Samantha tonight filmmaker Terry George, who directed the film Hotel Rwanda. I'm sure many of you saw it, the true life tale of Rwanda hotel manager Paul Rusesabagina, who used his considerable skills and resources to protect over 1,000 Tutsis fleeing genocide in 2004. He co-scripted In the Name of the Father, which is a great film with Jim Sheridan, made his feature directorial debut with Some Mother's Son, and collaborated again with Jim Sheridan on The Boxer. His most recent film was Reservation Road, based on the novel by John Burnham Shorts, who was just here a few weeks ago. And he is now working on a film about the life of Sergio Vieira de Mello, based on Samantha Power's book. Please welcome Terry George and Samantha Power to the LA Public Library.
Thanks. Did they mention that you were a fanatical Red Sox fan there?
Okay. somehow that came up. I don't know how.
I'm very thankful for Samantha making this a conversation because I'm in the middle of adapting the book at the minute to make a feature film. And every time I talk to Samantha, it gives me a scene or it expands how I feel about the character and try to find a nuance on it because it's
what he's really saying is he says, "How about this? I think this is what I say." No, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
That's not true. You can't do that to Sergio. That's what he's trying to say. It's so expansive, my understanding.
That's why I have the tape recorder here, just for validation. When we get sued 3 years from now, I'll say Samantha said it at the Tabor Auditorium. But let's go back. You tell me what attracted you to the character, and I'll tell you what attracted me.
That would be great. No, I'd love... Well, Sergio was somebody who was introduced to me while I was a rookie reporter in Bosnia in 1994. and the UN mission there was a disaster. It was known as the UN Protection Force, but nicknamed the UN Self-Protection Force because it wouldn't actually, the peacekeepers were very reluctant to use force to protect civilians, and the civilians had come to expect that people who were under the UN flag and who carried guns were going to protect them. So there was a big disconnect. And I heard that there was one exception to this otherwise faltering mission, and that was this dashing Brazilian diplomat who I was told was a cross between James Bond and Bobby Kennedy. And I think the James Bond part now, in retrospect, was, of course, the good looks and the charm and the ingenuity, and also the chasing of the flame, the moth to the flame quality of his life, the desire to be in war zones and so forth. And the Bobby Kennedy piece was, what was Arthur Schlesinger's great line about the difference between John F. Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, that John F. Kennedy was an idealist masquerading as a realist, and Bobby was a realist masquerading as an idealist. With Sergio, you can never tell. I think Terry and I have talked a lot about the ebbing and flowing of, he's always masquerading as something, and it's usually with civilian protection in mind. But this combination of qualities would be rare in any country, in any society, in any era. And the fact that those qualities went on the road for 34 years to the world's most broken places and the world's most violent places, at a time, well, I should say, the fact that he had lived in all those places, worked in 14 war zones, and risked his life, 100 times over, that experience and his learning, the fact that he was also a very adaptive fellow, which I think makes him very rare in any bureaucracy, actually quite self-critical, or not always initially, but had a capacity to do mid-course corrections. So then what you had is sort of the education of an idealist or the education of a realist in the world's worst places at precisely the time we as a country are groping, are grasping for a shepherd, for some guidance as to make our way, how to make our way through the muck of the 21st century at a time when we're all feeling a kind of crisis of legitimacy and a crisis of competence. So here was this person who never had a crisis of legitimacy or confidence, really, in his work in the field, had managed to grow and had been at all the seminal points where the action was, where the flames were. So in the 70s, he'd been in Africa and in Cyprus, dealing with the Turkish invasion in Cyprus, dealing with wars of decolonization and independence in Africa. When the action moved to the Middle East in the 80s, he was the person storming up to an Israeli general who crossed into southern Lebanon, Palestinians using the Israeli base from which, but behind which to launch attacks into northern Israel. The UN is in the middle, as it so often is, and Sergio's the young punk who goes running up to the Israeli commander and says, "What you've just done is unacceptable." And the commander said, "You think this is unacceptable? You should see the 50 tanks pulling up the rear. Now that's unacceptable." And so Sergio, the one who then decides from that point forward never to use the word unacceptable again, into the Berlin Wall falls. He's the guy who goes to negotiate with the Khmer Rouge, stares into the eyes of Ying Sari, and explores the nature of evil and how you actually deal with it in the real world. It's ideals in practice. Into the 90s, as you and I have talked about, Terry, Bosnia, where I met him, Rwanda, Congo, the beginnings of ethnic conflict and the breakdown of confederated states that had been sort of pulled together in post-colonial times. And then when nation building becomes all the issue du jour, he's the guy in charge of Kosovo, in charge of East Timor. When 9/11 happens and we have to figure out how to balance liberty and security, he's the human rights commissioner figuring out how to deal with George Bush. And then, of course, right down to the fateful deployment to Iraq and the tragic end to his life, first ever suicide attack in Iraq. And just as he'd been, actually should have said, in Beirut for the first suicide attack against an American installation in 1983, so too there he is in 2003, 20 years later, for the first evidence that al-Qaeda was going to take aim at any humanitarian target, at any soft target, at least in Iraq and arguably elsewhere. So you can't make this up. I mean, where did this life come from, and how could it be expired so needlessly without us trying to go into it to see if there's anything that we can take from it so we don't have to go to the bother of making the mistakes he made, but can short-circuit that learning? It just, as soon as one heard about Sergio's death, it was just, the instant reaction was, A, just incredible sadness, but also, B, just that sense of a waste. You know, all of this in the field, on the ground knowledge that finally now, as the United States, even the Bush administration, begins to grapple with the need for multinational solutions to global threats, you'd want a global guy. You'd want this go-to guy to turn to, and yet at just that moment, he's not around, and yet the record of his life was. So, but let me turn it back to you, because I went peddling. Terry and I had lunch after Hotel Rwanda came out, and I'd always thought that this, I know it seems maybe a little bit comical, but the one of the characters in my last book, Raphael Lemkin, who invented the word genocide and drafted the Genocide Convention, he was a Polish Jew whose family had been exterminated in the Holocaust, and just an indefatigable advocate, was a one-man lobbyist. I always thought it would make a great movie, like every author, of course, think every character, wouldn't that be a great movie? And so Terry had just put out Hotel Rwanda, which I was amazed by and grateful for, and he and I had lunch, and he says, oh, you know, what do you have to do? And I said, oh, I've got this great movie idea, Raphael Lemkin, this Polish, and of course, he's all genocided out, and his eyes just glaze over, and I could just see, and I'm trying to pull him back, and I'm just trying to get him, and he says, so what are you working on now? I said, it's just Sergio de Mello, you've never heard of him, the Brazilian, he's under the rubble in Iraq, and he just like, he's like, what? That guy? And so well, what was it that was in your head when you
Well, my daughter was, when he was killed, said to me, this guy was amazing, what he was trying to do. And because, you know, I didn't know who he was. Not many of us did. So when he was killed, I went and on her advice, I read a bit more and I thought, wow, this guy was trying to do good things. But then, and you know, our attention span in movies is so short. I moved on to other things, and then when I met Samantha and she said that, it clicked back to me, and I listened to what she was saying, and it was the same with Hotel Rwanda, that when I hear about a character or someone like Sergio or Paul that would allow me to use this person as the eyes of an audience, to take audiences inside the world of what he was trying to do and what he achieved and where he failed, to explain to audiences around the world, particularly about the United Nations, because many times, rightly, it has got a really bad rap. And you know, I, in Hotel Rwanda, kicked it around a bit because of that terrible failure that the UN was responsible for, but there are thousands of people like Sergio dedicating their lives to saving refugees, to trying to bring peace, standing in the middle of conflicts. And I thought, we have to learn about this organization through this fantastic character and not let it be demonized by this building on 42nd Street in New York. So that, for my sins, is what I took on, and 2 years later, I'm still
waiting for the script.
But I had to wait for the book. This, like, truth be told,
I'd get these text messages. I mean, it's really unusual. I know nothing about Hollywood or this business, but I would imagine it doesn't happen so often that a writer and a filmmaker meet, before the book is. I mean, I was just starting, really,
right,
in terms of the reporting. So I'd get these annoying text messages from my new Irish friend saying, "Are you typing?
Yeah.
How's the typing? You know, waiting." And I would feed him chapters as they would come off the printer in very, very rough form. And he'd say, "You really think people are going to have an appetite for 900 pages, you know, on I said, "It's not going to be 900 by then, Terry. You're just seeing it in rough, rough form."
Thank God it's down to 600. And I really regret that sentence, "Are you typing?" because it's going to come back to haunt me now. And the answer is yes.
Totally. But what was interesting as we, I mean, I found it, I've never collaborated with anybody just in my work in these big reporting projects. But it was really interesting because I remember when we did meet, it was very much a window into the UN, and which you mentioned again right now. That's how it started for me as well, was, okay, here's this behemoth of an organization, very poorly understood. When I traveled around the country for A Problem from Hell, inevitably there'd be somebody in the back of some bookstore or some university auditorium who'd say, "Okay, great, we understand the United States isn't going to do much about genocide, national interests, and all the rest, but what about the UN? Isn't it the UN's fault, really?" And I would sort of initially respond very earnestly to the question. Then I started to get a little impatient with the question because it underscored, I think, how much or how confused a lot of people are about what the UN is. Because the way the question was asked, it was as if the UN had a mind, an army, a bank account of its own, right? Instead of it being the equivalent of a building. In fact, the General Assembly chamber looks a little bit like this one, right? Where imagine each of you are an ambassador for your country, bringing your national interests into the building. Now, very bad things can happen in a room like this if each of you bring your national interests into the building. But if the building didn't exist, you'd still have your national interests. And the question is, and so the UN in some ways is going to be a symptom of how the member states or the powerful countries of the world value certain things and what their priorities are and how they allocate their resources and whether they care about genocide or whether they don't. And so I think when I, you know, also when Sergio died, I thought, well, this is, I mean, first of all, there's never been a better face for any humanitarian organization. And if any organization needs rehabilitation in the United States, it's the UN. Precisely at the time that we need to turn to global bodies to deal with global warming and counterterrorism and proliferation and refugee flows and so forth, we need to have a stronger and not a weaker humanitarian arm, at least. And yet, we need to alert people to the fact that until states change, the results that come out of a global body like the UN are not likely to be all that different than they have been. And so that was my earnest, I think, goal, was in a way to use Sergio as a Trojan horse into that organization. And what's interesting, both, I mean, actually, really largely thanks to conversations that I've had with you, Terry, was the degree to which the UN sort of, because I began to see Sergio as problem solver and troubleshooter, troublemaker, guy who tended to broken places, and because that then became, for me, I mean, in some senses, the means are almost incidental. The issue is, are you focusing on the challenges? Are you focusing on the problems? And then maybe the means take care of themselves. In other words, if the kinds of challenges, failing states and undergoverned places and violent people and evil people and homeless people and stateless people, if you could get member states to focus on those challenges, then maybe the institutional form would follow. And so two things then through our conversations became far more interesting than the organization, much to the relief of my publisher. one was, what is the arc of learning that one will have toward those challenges? Because that's what any state, whether they're part of the UN, want to embrace the UN or not, or any citizen who wants to think about sensibly about the future, we need to orient ourselves around those problems. And then your point, which is Sergio's arc and development as an idealist in practice, as an idealist in the world. And it almost became, it was walking in his footsteps and doing 400 interviews or whatever it ended up being, was like the education of an idealist, the education of Henry Adams, the education of Sergio Vieira de Mello. And that is, as you pointed out to me, more of a universal story where not only does the UN fade to black as a venue where he happens to be working, he's very devoted to the organization, but even the places he's working in, which all of which are case-specific and circumstance-specific, themselves fade to black. And what you have is a man trying, you know, or a Sisyphean image of somebody sort of pushing this boulder but kind of studying the contours of the scenery as he pushes it up the hill. And that's very different. I mean, it's you have a much more challenging artistic task ahead of you, which is to how you simultaneously make people care about each of these places that he's in so that the human stakes of what he's working on actually matter to people, but not having people get bogged down in the finer points of the Kosovo independence movement and the Timorese, you know, infighting in the parliament or whatever. But I think that the working with a filmmaker who's thinking in terms of a universal arc changed the book. I mean, you know, and having that kind of collaborative process, made it much more something that could have been in any almost time or place, but happened to be Sergio, and luckily happened to be the guy for now.
Yeah. Well, and that, I mean, when you have a person who's been in so many conflicts, he's basically a chronology of the conflicts of the last 35 years.
Mm.
Then that, at first, was an overwhelming challenge to me, but the thing that kept locking me in was his humanity, his desire to protect the helpless, to stand between, to foster or to help the UN be in this terrible position of drawing a line and being in between two factions or two tribes or two armies that want to kill each other. And coming to the realization that you can't do that, and also coming to the realization that if that peacekeeping is actually about peacemaking, that ordinary citizens, refugees, and need to feel secure and they need to have dignity, and those basic things carry on throughout those conflicts. So it's now I have this character where the conflicts don't matter. I don't have to explain them that much. You know you're in Sarajevo, or you know you're in Tanzania, or you know you're in East Timor, you know you're in Baghdad. It's his relationship to ordinary people and his relationship to authority, whether it's the Khmer Rouge or Milosevic or Karadzic. And, you know, he dealt with some of the greatest killers of the last 50 years and made mistakes in trying to placate them. And all of those things, I think, help to build up a character that ultimately will educate the audience to what the dedication of people in the UN is and what that organization is about, hopefully more than the kind of ridicule that we read every day. I mean, it was funny, when I was in East Timor 3 weeks ago and someone said, a UN representative said to me, the UN is the third world's revenge on the West. And that, I thought, okay, that makes sense now. And it explains the quagmire that is the big building in 42nd Street. But with Sergio, hopefully, I have a character that will not only entertain people because you want to be like that person or go along with them, but then subliminally get the message across that there are thousands of people trying to do the right thing around the world under this blue banner that Sergio cherished so much and held on to the charter of it like it was a Bible. It was his Quran almost, you know, that devotion to an idea, but epitomized in a very flawed guy.
Yeah, no, hugely flawed. But I think part of this education, I have just the last couple of years at Harvard taught a very small seminar of freshmen the book, The Life. And it's been, I'm almost sad the book has come out, because what was great about having it in draft form was I would give the students, they were all freshmen, so they were sort of 17, 18 years old. Many of them had done Model UN, it was its own mini session of the General Assembly at Harvard, you know, students from all over the world. But what was great in passing out chapters is I could withhold so they couldn't read forward. So they'd have to actually be with Sergio as a 19-year-old in Paris studying political philosophy at the Sorbonne, or as a, in 1968, throwing stones at Parisian police, or at making as though he was pretending to throw stones at American cars if he saw them driving down the streets of Paris. He wore his leftism very, very loudly. And so they would stay with him, mad at the Brazilian government for forcing his father into retirement after the junta took over in the coup. And then they would stay with him when he joined the UN, and he was a dreamer, and he was a humanitarian, and he thought, you know, that feeding people was an end in itself, that there was a pure humanitarian imperative, and that motivated him. And he was hugely proud of the nobility of that exercise, and a little bit, not exactly naive, but mainly oblivious to the degree to which the structural sources of violence would not be dealt with unless you actually dealt with state power. In other words, he thought you could just feed and you could sort of stay apart from the state because he was an anti-imperialist, he was an anti-American. And it was not long, though, when he realized that you, in Bosnia, the expression was that you'd be passing out sandwiches at the gates of Auschwitz if you weren't careful, and that this kind of neutrality that you mentioned could be complicity in the face of evil. But what's interesting about the young people, anyway, so I am able to freeze them in particular missions as they walk in his footsteps. It's an amazing teaching tool. I mean, it's the best teaching tool I've ever had. But what's fascinating is, and maybe this is a little bit inside baseball, but at the beginning of the semester when I ask why they're taking the class, we go around and some of them say, oh, I'm taking it because I believe in human rights and I believe the UN is the body on earth, you know, in the charter is fundamental freedoms and human rights. And the title of the seminar is something, Can the UN Be Fixed? Is the UN the Problem? That's the title of this little seminar. And so a lot of them talk about human rights, and then we go around, the next person might talk about justice and the importance of justice and accountability. And the third person will say, I'm a humanitarian, I want to be an aid worker when I grow up, or at least in my 20s and my 30s, I want to join the Peace Corps. And somebody else will just talk about peace, about how the UN is the place where peace will be brokered. So here are these concepts, and they all kind of nod at one another, and these concepts of human rights, humanitarianism, peace, justice, they're synonyms in the eyes and in the minds and the hearts of these young people, and they're all, idealists. And by the end of the course, or by the end of the journey with Sergio, all these concepts get problematized. This doesn't make them dour and believe that there's no hope, or that, the international system is hopeless, or that the boulder will come and crush you as you try to push it up a hill, but they get a sophisticated understanding about the degree to which in Congo, Sergio has to make a choice between feeding people, Hutu, who've fled out of Rwanda after the genocide into neighboring countries. That's a pure humanitarian imperative. Now, in feeding people, he knows that he's also going to be feeding some of the genocidaire. If you're a human rights person, you don't feed the genocidaire. You denounce the genocidaire. You demand the arrest of the genocidaire. And in that instance, Sergio goes initially in the direction of the humanitarian imperative, and then eventually decides to be part of actually forcing the refugees back in the hopes of separating the sheep from the wolves. Peace and justice. What do you do if you're Sergio and you're negotiating either with the Khmer Rouge or with Milosevic? Bring them into the room. Right. And that's a balance, right, is because sometimes you bring your principles to the room, you're told to go away, especially if you're powerless and you don't have an army behind you, as a UN guy is. But I think that this, opening up of what idealism even means, and I mean, it's a risky proposition on my part in this book, because it can be daunting to be like, oh, geez, I thought these principles, I thought being for human rights that I had set myself a clear course. And now you're telling me that if I'm for human rights, that sometimes I have to be for turning off the spigot of international life support, of humanitarian aid, like, do not compute. And yet, if we're going to do this well, and not just, and if these kids are not going to go into the world and be disabused by the reality they find in the world, better that they be disabused as college freshmen and then develop kind of sophisticated means of thinking about these questions so they get out in the world and can grapple with them.
Yeah, I mean, for me also, it's a character that the movie's loved to some degree, because he's kind of an adrenaline junkie in the same way that, those journalists that have been in every war or the soldiers that have been in every war, he can't stay away from that notion of getting in there. But as the good knight, I came up with like a mythological story of this knight who doesn't use the sword, the white knight, but fights these dragons. I'm always trying to, like, In the Name of the Father was actually Pinocchio, the story of Pinocchio, the wooden boy who's swallowed up in the belly of the whale, and the father who goes in to rescue him and dies, and the good boy comes out. That was In the Name of the Father. But so we constructed a sort of mythological story about the white knight who won't use the sword, and it fights these dragons, but then has to recruit the other knights and fool them into, fighting the dragon for him and manipulating them. But the strange thing is, he keeps meeting this one dragon that grows bigger and bigger throughout his career, which was Islamic fundamentalism. And finally, it eats him at the end. And that was true because in Lebanon, in 81, was it 81? Yeah.
That's when he arrived, anyway.
When he arrived, he was there when the UN was basically pushed aside and completely shunted, and Reagan and
multinational force.
It was a multinational force, French, Italian, British came in to pacify Beirut, essentially, and get the PLO out. And lo and behold, they were there for 6 weeks, and Hezbollah committed the first big suicide bomb, the blowing up of the American embassy and the Marine barracks. And so Sergio sees that starting off, and it followed that, even in Bosnia and Timor, where Indonesia was a Muslim state, and eventually Al-Qaeda and Zarqawi and bin Laden probably directly ordered the killing of Sergio because he had stolen they believed he had taken East Timor, the UN had stolen East Timor away from the biggest Muslim nation in the world. So there's this weird connection throughout it, which I'm, as a movie maker, I need everything to be neatly compacted. But it just seemed to me kind of bizarre that this fantastic sort of man who stood up for what represented good, even though he's a flawed, you know, like we all are flawed human beings, he represented the best of humanity, and he was stalked throughout his life by the worst of it.
Well, I think that the it's interesting. I haven't seen Terry in a while. Been busy with a certain campaign and not thinking enough about Sergio, maybe. But it's interesting. I haven't heard him say that before about this idea of the stalking horse or stalking dragon or whatever. But when we talked at one point, we talked about how in this kingdom with the good knight, interacting with the king and trying to basically figure out his relationship between shield and sword, and trying to get the king to give him some sword also at a certain point. Also, I should say, having affairs with all the king's daughters. that's Terry's addition.
Until he meets the beautiful princess.
Until he meets the beautiful princess and so forth. And they.
We can do this as a cartoon. You know, it'd be much cheaper.
Believe me, I got to fulfill the second book of my two-book contract somehow, so I think a children's book on the kingdom. But what struck me when we spoke the last time that I also think is perhaps pertinent is the hubris that there's two things going on. One is the hubris of the do-gooder that he has in some measure. That is, because his intentions are not those of a state, they're not about amassing more power for Brazil or oil or anything like that. It's pretty straightforwardly some combination of those principles I mentioned earlier: peace, justice, civilian protection, human rights, humanitarianism, in whatever doses. But because of that, there is an assumption that somehow that those good intentions are going to be evident to the people who you're working with. And in Timor, he bumped up against the fact that while they were thrilled to be rid of the Indonesians and grateful to the UN for the role the UN had played in ending the Indonesian occupation, they also very much wanted to govern themselves and not be ruled even by a UN administrator. So I think he was a little slow to the uptake on he was great on dignity, universally great on dignity throughout his career, but one of the places that I think that concept got entrenched in him was understanding that even the UN, even the do-gooders, could unwittingly trample the dignity of free people who want to govern their own, govern themselves. So one piece of, just back to the scary monsters, so there's the hubris that he has born of good intentions, and then there's an equally seductive hubris, which is that of technical expertise, the kind of cult of the expert. I mean, Sergio, by the time he died, was a decathlete of nation building. You know, he knew reconstruction. He knew transitional justice. He knew policing. He knew demobilization of soldiers. You know, he knew elections. He knew constitution drafting. He had refugee returns. I mean, you name it. Whatever the 10 skills are, you can make up the skills. Schools. Utilities. He didn't necessarily know how to do all those things. He wasn't omniscient, but he knew who to call. Whereas to contrast that with Bremer and the people who went to Iraq, of course, had none of those skills, hadn't been involved in those kinds of tasks. The Americans, with the exception of Bosnia, had largely sat out a lot of the major nation-building tasks of the previous decade and kind of ridiculed the UN for even getting involved in them. But I mentioned these two sort of forms of hubris, maybe even too pejorative, but there was a confidence that he had that, and part of one of those skills in the decathlon is just being able to negotiate with harm doers, with evil doers. And when we talked at one point, we talked about the degree to which he came to believe that he could negotiate with anybody, that skill set, the do-gooderism, that equipped him to be able to sit down with Muqtada al-Sadr, or to be able to sit down, frankly, with Jerry Bremer, or to be able to sit down with Radovan Karadzic, and not to equate all these figures, but to say that there's an ideology at work with each of them, right? And And what we, in our very first conversation about the scary monsters and the kingdom, one of the things that I think struck both of us is that he didn't see the monster. In other words, you're right that it was recurring throughout his life, but he did actually believe that the UN flag would protect the Canal Hotel headquarters. He didn't get that Al-Qaeda was in some other league of harm-doer. That is, once you've negotiated with the Khmer Rouge and negotiated with the Bosnian Serb army and seen civilians ravaged before you, negotiated with the genocidaire from Rwanda, I mean, as you said, I mean, I wrote that down, you know, dealt with the killers of the last 50 years. So the idea that there was a new breed of killer and that that somehow the shield and the rule book meant nothing, you know, it didn't...
Well, he was he's a 20th century man and a 20th century politician into the 21st century dealing with those systems, and suddenly this medieval force comes along that I think... In this sophisticated man's kind of vocabulary was outside the notion that you could go and negotiate with that. And I'm sure had he lived in Iraq and he'd, because he, in Timor, I mean, this was like a test tube for Sergio, where he's given a country, a brand new country, and told, create a nation, create a political system. They had no currency, they had no post office, they had no water system. It was devastated by they had nothing, but they get independence. So, and Sergio did things that, now I was in East Timor 3 weeks ago, like he made the currency the US dollar, because how do you start printing money, you know, for East, who designs the coin, where is it done? Those sort of practical things. And it's funny, and you know, trying to educate what's essentially a guerrilla army and a national liberation front to suddenly become a government and to become a police force. And now there's a constituency in Timor that Sergio handed over power way too fast, because the Timorese, after a few years, suddenly started to, because, you know, the mechanisms of government created a dynamic among the previous guerrillas where they splintered and fell apart, and some of the army took to the mountains, and now the states and a bit of the UN are back, and they're trying to recreate the process that Sergio did, but take it slower to a degree. But still, for all of that, any of his failures came from a point of decency and from a point of trying to negotiate with evil, and trying to come to trying to make sure that he could shepherd people through, or away from pain and suffering and hunger. And in Sarajevo, where he probably failed most, I guess, because he bought into the notion of the UN protected zones, which were a disaster, and obviously ended up with Srebrenica. But at the same time, he was running an underground railway to get people out and, you know, smuggling food into people. His intentions, even as his pragmatism taught him that he had to do certain things, his intentions were still, you know, the sort of St. Francis of, I'm going to feed these people, I'm going to smuggle people out. So there's a nobility there that's very attractive and just inspirational to me.
Well, I think what he never got wrong, however he may have tipped, and again, hindsight is 20/20, to have had to make any of the choices he had to make, to me, would be a very unenviable kind of career path. I mean, these are excruciating. The entire terrain he operates in is lesser evil. Right, because he's in places. By definition, if the UN is sent, it means that no single country cares enough to go and invade itself or go do the deed itself. Right. So, what the UN was meant to be was back in the day was the place we parked our principles and a place where, again, all of you ambassadors would come and come together and talk about the commons that was being neglected, and that you would pool your resources. In the event, what it is for the most part, somebody like Sergio comes to each of you ambassadors and tries to extract a teeny bit of resource. You know, it's like an Oliver Twist scene, you know, more please. Man and woman by man, you know, and just to sort of pool a little bit of your resources and a little bit of yours and a little bit of yours, and to create just enough through smoke and mirrors and through this extraction, that's what it amounts to get back to the commons and to bring something in the way of decency. And so sometimes if he wants to get money out of you or troops out of you, he's willing to not say things or willing to trade certain things off that if you look at it from now, you might think, how could you have done that, Sergio? How could have you agreed to have been reticent, for instance, about George Bush and the Geneva Conventions in the spring of 2003? Here he is going to war in Iraq. I mean, how could you be reticent about him going to war in Iraq? And Sergio said, well, because I'm human rights commissioner and I want to be able to get access to the detention facilities. I don't want to get... Bush hates the UN. We know that. So if I denounce him publicly, what are the odds of ever making a difference in terms of U.S. practices in detention facilities, or what are the odds of getting a U.N. human rights presence into Iraq in the wake of the invasion that we know is going to happen regardless of what I, a Brazilian U.N. diplomat, say about things. But so it's all lesser evils, and like you say, I mean, you can look back on specific choices and really see the cataracts, that would develop in him and the bad choices he made or the lunging here or there. But to your point, I mean, what he never seemed to get wrong was the dignity of those around him. He had an uncanny ability. You would think this would be more commonplace, but to disaggregate the human in human rights or the human in humanitarian. And so whether that meant being in Iraq and dealing with the nightmare of Bremer and the occupation, and yet remembering to wire money to his, as was said, I think, in the introduction, to his cleaning lady in East Timor so she could put her two girls through school, whether it meant the train that you mentioned, the Underground Railroad, that he ran out of the backseat of his car in Sarajevo to smuggle people out. This is the same guy who's called Sergio and who, you know, reveres the UN and wants to remain within the institution for the rest of his career, who's basically breaking UN rules, using UN vehicles and so forth to move civilians. You'd think that would be okay. It's totally against the rules. But that ability to see people in their entirety. And I think some people who read the book couldn't care less about broken places, couldn't care less about the UN as such when they put it down. I mean, I hope that's not true of most readers, but a lot of people, what they most respond to in him is this dignity point. Insofar as it has bearing for all of us, right? We've all lived our lives around people, who could have stood to be seen as more visible than we see them as. And Sergio actualizes that core, I think, micro principle of dignity. But I also think what his life does for me, also as I think about fixing American foreign policy, if you could imagine governments, you know, in meetings having a kind of dignity meter or a dignity constraint on the worst condescension of interstate relations, or a dignity motivator, not just as a check, but also as a galvanizer, it would change the way you thought about whether spending $3 billion on refugee camps in Darfur was a success, right? I mean, the Bush administration boasting, and again, they've done more on Darfur than any other government, so in some ways, they have at least, they've done something, and it's because of the activism of Americans. But to boast about keeping people on life support, and the way we talk about it, we say, I mean, some diplomats, they go in these, aid workers do this too, they say, you know, I don't know why they want to go back to their villages. I mean, they have running water in the camps, you know, and you have these people, all they want to do is go home and go to the well and do what they do. It's their life, it's their choice, and yet we have a way of, and as we promote democracy, we promote democracy in a way that may be great if we could promote democracy successfully or effectively, but we do it in such a way that it's an affront to the dignity of the people that we're promoting those objectives for, because we're telling them, yeah, we like democracy, but we don't like those outcomes, we don't like those parties, we just like the ones that are, you know, and so if there was a way to take Sergio's disaggregation of those around him as a micro takeaway, and then as a macro, you know, policy tool or sensibility to take this idea of dignity. I mean, it seems to me that those are the most valuable pieces of his life. Now, I should say the big footnote, of course, to all this is his own family and whether or not that regard applied to them in the same way that it would have to complete strangers.
Yeah, because...
Which will be the subject of Terry's movie,
it
of
is,
course.
Yeah.
Because when you're making a movie, you can't. It's extremely hard to tell a purely. It's impossible to tell a purely political story, pretty much, or even get close to that, as the last year's box office proves. And Samantha, it's funny. A year ago, we were talking about a certain figure of the budget, and then today, Samantha caught me where I had actually halved the figure of the budget. Because of what happened this year, where basically not one single political movie made any money at the box office. And that legacy, I now inherit onto Sergio, but thankfully he had an extremely adventurous romantic life. And was well known. I interviewed the president of East Timor, Jose Ramos Horta, a few weeks ago, just before he was shot.
Terry brings the weather where
I know.
He
yeah,
goes.
Yeah. It's, hi, I'm from Northern Ireland, Duck. but he said, you know, Sergio was a bit of a womanizer, and everybody said that's like the second sentence they say to you, you know, or he liked the ladies, but Ramos Horta said it with a. And sometimes I have that reputation as well. And you could see this twinkle in his eye, the competition. And he was, you know, there were jokes about if you throw a stone down a street in Bosnia, you're going to hit one of Sergio's kids or something like that. And and then he meets, you know, and he has the sort of what they'd call in L.A., the intellectual trophy wife in France, Anna, who stays there with the kids. And but in Timor, he meets this woman who steals his heart away. And it's at the same moment for me where the evolution of what he practiced in politics and learning about nation building, suddenly he meets this woman who, you know, puts him in his place, as your previous. You can't be saving the world and treat women like, you know, just personal baggage that you ditch wherever you go. And he did. He left like a trail of broken hearts around the world. And suddenly he meets this woman who changes his life and helps him find a purpose to it and defines it. And they're heading towards that marriage and a life together that's truly shared. And, of course, he gets pressured to go to Baghdad and she goes with him. And it's that, you know, it's the same end. It's the Zhivago Reds ending where just as somebody's coming to a fruition in their life, the dragon, the monster appears and eats them. And that's a good movie. But it was the same with Hotel Rwanda. I needed this hotel manager who was obsessed with looking after people and fine wine and, you know, the chocolates and the whole thing to sell the story of the Rwandan genocide, because as I learned to my cost last October, an audience does not want to go in and see either politics or, in my case, a dead child in the road, as I call it, a movie called Reservation Road that I made that disappeared in about 4 days. So, and it is entertainment. And within the possibility of this amazing character, and he has this mix of sort of the Warren Beatty, Bill Clinton thing, especially when I talked around East Timor, where he would engage someone and they'd be totally, they're in Sergio's cocoon. He's listening to them, they feel they're being listened to, and he invigorates them. And that charisma has always fascinated me, that a person, and particularly a person who uses it for a noble purpose, but also used it, obviously, to charm lots of young women around the world. Mm. So there's conflict and there's a character there that hopefully at the same time we do tell the story of the basic nobility of the UN. And the single thing that I pose to people when they talk about, what would we do without it? It's totally flawed. It is the third world's revenge.
There's no it though, Tara. I think you're on
well,
the
yeah.
it.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
very
I mean,
much on the it. I think we've got to move away from the it.
Well, the it of the people who work there as a frame of mind.
Right. I guess I just feel like we buy into it. I mean, you know, if we replace the word it with the major powers, for instance, or often the United States and China and Russia or Europe, or because I mean, when one contrasts the flaws of the Sergios or that civil service, those 9,000 people work for the UN, with the flaws of countries that are rooted, or at least how those countries operate in their dealings with other countries and other people, just there's a discrepancy, right? And so I'm all for talking about flaws of, as you can see from the book, I mean, of Sergio and everybody else who is an agent in the world and in these broken places. But I think it's somehow we've got to get the proportions right, you know, which is a challenge.
Yeah, and it is explaining. I mean, United Nations, it should be called DN probably. But for me, it always is the characters and the personalities that you meet. And, you know, and he in my movie head, he has a nemesis, this New Zealander, Dennis McNamara, who keeps coming and saying, pointing out his flaws all the time.
Yeah. Who's his best friend.
Right. Who's his best friend.
And his conscience, and who Sergio brings with him on every mission, basically. And you wonder, like, why do you want somebody, I mean, it's like marrying somebody, and you wake up in the morning and they say, you're immoral. You're like, thank you. How nice. And that's honestly, that was McNamara's role in his life. But Sergio was always the boss, so he kept bringing him. So he wanted that conscience.
Yeah. Though the strange thing was he didn't want to hear it in Timor. He brings Dennis and he sidelines him.
Yeah.
You know, and the first time he's really got the chance, I think, I don't want to hear. Don't hit me with those negative waves, you know.
No, totally. The one thing I was thinking earlier that might be just worth mentioning, because I don't know if we're going to have questions that would be great.
Jeez, we talk, Irish people talk way too much.
That's the problem, you get two of them. No drink or anything yet.
To the gap.
But all I was going to say, maybe it'll come up in the questions, but was just, because Terry told the story of Carolina and just the tragedy of that. But just a word on the end, I guess, for those of you who don't know, but so Carolina had the office sort of diagonal from Sergio's deliberately so they could check in on each other, and during the course of the day of this very, very exasperating mission in Iraq, where the guy who'd been in charge of Timor and in charge of Kosovo and the go-to guy in the entire international system was relegated to basically being like a gnat, you know, a UN gnat who was trying to get Bremer to listen to him on a range of these very technical issues that couldn't have saved Iraq had Sergio been listened to, but could have rendered the place certainly more humane and I think less dangerous over the course of that summer and maybe even into subsequent months. But when the Al-Qaeda suicide bomber pulled up outside Sergio's office, there was almost no protection outside it, because he did believe that the UN flag would be protection. It has to be said, because we project what we know of Iraq today back on that time, that there'd never been an attack on a civilian target before. All the attacks had been against the Americans, who were seen, of course, by many as the occupiers. So, and Sergio's office was very vulnerable. It was the most vulnerable office in the entire UN headquarters, which was in part because, again, I don't think he felt hugely vulnerable, although he began to just the week or two before the attack. But it was also that he didn't want, somebody asked him if he wanted to move offices. He said, well, why would I move a more junior member of my staff into a more vulnerable office? Like, what would that be? I'm the boss, right? I mean, why? It just means someone has to be in this office, and so better it be me. So there was something, I think, you know, very good about that response. But suicide bomber came up and parked the car or the truck right in just behind Sergio's office unimpeded and basically detonated it. And the initial miracle was that Sergio survived this unprecedented attack that would go on to kill 22 people, of course, including him. But he survived, and he landed not quite upside down, but with his head beneath his legs, pinned beneath rubble, beside an American refugee advocate, Gil Loescher, and he waited to be saved. And what is so shocking, there's so many reasons to be angry and devastated by the human costs of the war in Iraq, but just to add one to your list that will be very personal by this time, if you read the book or in Terry's movie, because you will have grown so attached to this guy grappling with the problems of today and trying to help the stateless people and the failing states and so forth. And here he is, effectively pinned under the rubble, stateless. I mean, like a refugee waiting rescue. And the infuriating part of this tragedy is that although the Bush administration predicated the war in Iraq on a link between, in part, on a link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11 and large-scale attacks on civilian targets, no planning, no preparation was done in the U.S. military to respond to large-scale attacks on civilian targets. So in other words, if you were arguing that Saddam was linked to these kinds of things, surely we would think, surely. But the result was then that there was no search and rescue capacity and that Sergio waited in vain for the world or the Americans to come. And Terry and I were talking about this just before coming out here, but two American soldiers, one EMT and one American fireman, went into the hole, risked their lives. I mean, heroic. The building is shaking. Things are on fire. Wires are sparking. There's mud everywhere. People are, you know, could suffocate under the rubble. And they go in there to save him. I mean, it's the best of what we imagine of America. And yet all they have to rescue this invaluable figure is a lady's handbag that somebody has retrieved from one of the offices in the Canal Hotel, one of those basket handbags, a curtain rope from, you know, pulled out off one of the windows that then is attached to the handbag so it becomes a kind of amateur pulley system, MacGyver-like, right, in the middle of, but not MacGyver, because so these young men pulling and using their helmets to sort of dig away and to try to put in this basket the rubble, whereas what you needed was jaws of life, cutting equipment, cranes, even just basic plywood to shore up the walls of the shaft. And so the idea that Sergio is left himself, I think, a monument to the places we don't get to, you know, to the places that the UN has the equivalent of handbags and curtain ropes dealing with those broken places and those untended places. It's a devastating end and a devastating metaphor.
Yeah, and Carolina trying to dig him out, you know, this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the end of the movie.
Thank you.
We should do questions, yeah? Sure. There we go, first hand up.
Samantha, I really appreciate your insight, and every time I hear you speak, I'm really impressed and frankly very thankful that you're working for the Obama campaign. I have a great deal of hope based on that. I heard you on Charlie Rose the other day, and when you mentioned the 83 bombing in Beirut, it reminded me that growing up in Virginia, one of my neighbors was Robert Ames, and he was killed in that bombing. And we didn't realize it until afterwards that he was a very high-ranking CIA official at the American Embassy. And it made me think, what was Sergio's relationship with the CIA, if in fact there was one?
He would have been, up until that point in his career, up until Lebanon, would have retained that, let's call it youthful anti-Americanism, youthful anti-imperialism. I don't think there would have been any chance prior to, let's say, the mid-80s or even the fall of the wall, where Sergio would have had any kind of, partly he was working mainly in humanitarian affairs rather than political affairs, which is sort of, again, a small point, but I don't think there would have been any relationship to speak of. I have no evidence of any subsequent relationship. I mean, there's certainly no, I can't imagine any kind of cozy relationship at any stage or any kind of reciprocal relationship, nothing like that. But what I will say is that as part of his shedding of this hyper-idealism and this kind of exclusionary idealism where there were good guys and bad guys, like the blacks and the whites of his youth kind of faded away, what I would imagine in the 90s is that if the CIA wanted to meet with Sergio about Indonesian militia in the bush in West Timor, he would have been delighted to have that meeting. If the CIA wanted to meet with him in the former Yugoslavia, and there were certainly people around who were wearing two hats at the U.S. mission in Bosnia, that much I know, I have every expectation that he would have met with them, if nothing else, out of frustration that American intelligence on ethnic conflict was so shoddy. So he began, the same guy who would meet with George Bush would not, even as a Latin American who saw the CIA's hand in the overthrow of so many Latin American leaders and in the support for the very military regime that was part of forcing his dad into retirement, which was one of the reasons he turned his back on Brazil in the first place. So he would have never forgotten what the CIA was capable of or had done in its history. But in this pragmatic last decade of his life, he would have thought that, you know, the problem in the 90s anyway was not too much American involvement in broken places, but actually too little regard and or too little understanding, and wouldn't have had any kind of clean hands doctrine about who he could talk to.
The one time he was completely disillusioned with the U.S. or would resign was when it was announced or exposed that the U.N. inspectors in Iraq looking for weapons of mass destruction had been British and American spies, and that really freaked him out completely.
That's sort of a separate, I mean, it's totally related because it gives you a sense, again, of that disdain, but also it gives you a sense of his almost virginal reverence for the UN. I mean, his colleagues were like, wait, so these were UN weapons inspectors who were reporting back to their government. So they were American citizens who worked in Iraq for the UN. So they carried blue passports. That matters so much to Sergio. They didn't carry, they carried baby blue, Carolina blue passports, UN passports. And that they could see themselves as answering to Washington or to Langley was outrageous to him. But it wasn't exactly their CIA-ness that was outrageous to him. It was that they were using the UN as cover for their national interests. And again, he never quite got used to the dualism of this institution, that it could be for weapons inspection. That's a UN function. That's something only independent third parties can do. And yet, what is the UN but a gathering of these states? And so you had Sergio's colleagues just saying, Sergio, duh. What do you think, like, you know, Americans just work for the UN and they don't have any residual relationship with their host governments? And as Terry said, I mean, it's the one time in his very long career of frustration with member states that he actually contemplates leaving the organization out of disgust. I mean, it's an important correction.
Here we go. I hate being the arbiter who picks people's questions.
Have you given any thought to casting the movie yet?
Nah. Tell him about Jim Sheridan talk. Tell her about Jim Sheridan talk.
This is a little anecdote. When you know, Jim Sheridan is my partner in a lot of movies, and we write together or did write together. And any time that I knew that he was stuck or procrastinating, he'd call up and say, "You think Daniel could play this part?" You know? And or else, you know, Leonardo would be really good as Claudius. And I think, Jim, get back to the typewriter. And, of course, you cast it every night. And but as I say to Samantha, the person who can get me X million dollars.
There is a number.
There's a number. And that's the price. You have to think like that, you know. I mean, there are a lot of actors who would be great. I'm sure there's a lot of Brazilian actors who would be fantastic, but that ain't happening, you know. It's just you have to be pragmatic about, I've got to do four wars, you know, and four wars, you know, 16 fantastic-looking women with hair and makeup and the United Nations building, so I have to be more pragmatic than Sergio. And that's saying something. Sorry.
Hi, thanks, Samantha. You and I were actually classmates at Yale. We had lunch conversations at Davenport, graduated in 93. And I remember one of the themes that we discussed, one of the topics, was the media. And the Trilateral Commission was my big thing at the time.
Gosh, it wouldn't have been mine. I don't think. Wasn't I talking about sports back then?
This is the end of the Cold War, and the end. Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History, came out. Here's my question. Looking at 9/11 and looking at the developments since 9/11 with respect to the U.S. media, its coverage in the lead-up to the March invasion in 2003, and I know you worked for U.S. News and World Report right after Yale, and then I think you went to another paper. The Council on Foreign Relations today is something that was architected by the Rockefeller family with Brzezinski, who's a foreign policy advisor in the same campaign you're working for, Obama's campaign. Here's the question in a lot of people's minds. The thrust into Iraq had a lot to do with oil and with natural resources and control of the region. And a lot of people believe that Brzezinski, not Brzezinski, but the Council on Foreign Relations and this unholy alliance between U.S. corporations and the media in this country enabled that lack of will that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Not the lack of ability to prevent genocides, et cetera, but the lack of will in the American people. Mm-hmm. And how do you both, as journalists, as media people, grapple with the amazing blackout that's unfolded in this country over the last 6 years with respect to dissent, mm-hmm. in terms of the average person's access to Fox and CNN, mm-hmm. and the deep power concentration that has happened in American media. So I'm asking you, what's your take now on journalism and on the media and the enabling of the lack of will in the American people to hold their leaders accountable?
Okay. It's a great question. I think that the media complicity or quiescence in the run-up to the war in Iraq was overdetermined. That is, I think there were a range of other factors ranging from just the fact that there was a stupor. Terry may have a different view than me on this, but a stupor and a pall that was cast across the entire country. I mean, not just the media. In other words, if you did a sampling of journalists and did a sampling of citizens, I don't think journalists were more quiescent. They just have a greater responsibility to be less quiescent because it's their job. So what I'm saying is the same thing that made Dan Rather cry, and journalists, many television journalists, even print journalists, wear flags on their lapels and just sort of feel like they had been attacked, that they had to respond, that they were part almost of the government response, I think it was a major factor. I also think, I just think this weird, it was almost like somebody injected the press corps with this kind of immobilizing device, or where the sort of muscle of skepticism grew far, far weaker. So I say that first instead of talking immediately about corporate control and so forth, because I actually think it was a bigger factor. I mean, I think that, you know, I have a column now at Time Magazine just for the last 6 months or so, and I happen not to have had the column before the war in Iraq, but it's I'm probably not, you know, on the far left of the political spectrum or anything, so maybe I'm not a good example, but I'm certainly against the war in Iraq. I have no reason to think that if I'd had my column at Time Magazine that they would have somehow objected to me writing my column because of Time Warner, whoever the hell they're owned by this week. You know, I just think there were other things going on, but what I want to say just about the media now, which I think is, but so, the corporate issue is massively important, but for a different reason than you're suggesting, I think. But it has the same effect, so maybe it doesn't matter. Which is that the premium on making money makes these kinds of issues unmarketable, unsellable. In other words, I see it less, and maybe I'm naive, but less as political cahoots and more as kind of financial gaming of what works, of what sells, and thus the appetite for this kind of stuff and for drawing attention either to dissent or to critical views of the U.S. government, that's not going to sell in that period between 2001 and 2004, because, again, they're looking to the American people. They're sort of focus grouping their way to understanding. It's like market testing of truth. You can't market test truth, right? There should be some bandwidth that's independent of where, you know, it should be all the information you need to know, not that you necessarily want to know. So I think this is a really, really big factor in terms of what it excludes, in terms of controversial opinion, but also places that are not, don't seem immediately pertinent either to our core national security or financial interests. A further concern I have is, and this is a very, perhaps a banal point, but is the concern about the daily me, the daily Samantha movement here that we all get to put into our search engines the five topics that are dearest to us, you know, so I'll put the Red Sox, George Clooney, you know, whatever, right? But I'm not going to, at 22, after Yale, I'm not going to put genocide or concentration camps or, I'm not, you know, so how is the next generation going to stumble into awareness, new knowledge? I mean, even the way the Times structures its websites, you know, where you have to click on the headline, but the headlines often aren't headlines that even tell you anything about the content of the story. There's just, we're yeah, this is, again, I hate being part of this rant about the internet and so forth, but it's just our preferences, we're just getting more and more streamlined. It's the same thing that has Dick Cheney, when he goes to a hotel, you know, all concierges, all hotels are under explicit instructions that all the TVs should be on in his suite and all of them should be on Fox News. And, it, you know, anybody, you know, there's hell to pay if any of the TVs, God forbid, is on the Comedy Channel or MTV or never mind CNN. So I think there are other factors that are really worrying in when one thinks about dissent and foreign policy and the humanization in general of the way we do our business in the world.
And I have the solution in one sentence, which is that we should deport Rupert Murdoch and that'll be half the problem solved. And that'll probably get me deported now. Yeah. Next.
I think we should probably move away from this lovely
section.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, yeah. Okay. We're going to
one of the things that you criticized Sergio for was not taking sides, particularly in places like Cambodia, where he's speaking to the Khmer Rouge, or in Bosnia. Given the structure of the UN with the Security Council and the veto power, you know, unless you can get all the permanent members to agree, the UN really isn't in a position to take sides. I mean, how would you restructure the UN, or what type of organization could take sides?
Well, you know, I would hate for the takeaway to be we've got to take sides, right? I mean, I think that Sergio's point in the end would have been we need to take sides. And the side that we're taking is, as best we can, the application of these principles, as distinct from this kind of such a blind devotion to neutrality that you're not even noticing who's violating the principles more. You know, so if the side you're taking is to these, now these are fungible, as I've discussed, and so forth. So this isn't a perfect formula, but in an ideal world, you'd have countries that were in serving on the UN Security Council. And they'd be looking around the world and aggrieved if they found international peace and security threatened, fundamental freedoms threatened, mass atrocity committed, that would be the side that they were on. The trouble now, as your question suggests, of course, is that we've entered and exited the period of the sole superpower. Now, many in this room, I'm sure, who are relieved that period has passed. But you may be nostalgic for that period once one enters the era of the Chinese superpower, the Russian superpower, and the American superpower at once squaring off. And in the council, like you're suggesting, clogging the functionality of that body, whether one has to frame it in terms of side-taking or just in terms of responding, I mean, to Burma or to, if it comes to that, Iranian enrichment or to Darfur, humanitarian and national security challenges. Look at Kosovo, total stalemate. So I wrote my column in Time this week about this very issue of just U.S. and Russia. It's not just about Russia's historic relationship to the Orthodox Christians of Serbia. It's about the same thing that had Putin planting that flag in the North Pole. It's basically him flipping off the United States, flipping off the West, and asserting himself in the one place that he's got equal clout as the United States. I think you're going to see a workaround if this continues. I mean, I don't blame the council. I mean, insofar as the council, as I said earlier, is an accurate reflection of the clog in the international system. I mean, the three most powerful countries right now are at odds with one another, Russia and China creeping closer to one another. But I think if the United States feels as though on issue after issue that is of concern to its own national interest, the Security Council is offering no succor, no support, no response, you're going to see probably the evolution. NATO will become more and more of a body that, like in Afghanistan, it acts and responds. You'll probably see the G8 or, you know, major economic powerhouses uniting. But I think you're going to see a proliferation of institutional structures around function. You know, you'll probably see a new organization around global warming. You might even see a new organization eventually around the responsibility to protect, around peacekeeping, if there's a feeling that if we can do no thought experiment. Like, imagine Terry's the subject of Terry's movie, Rwanda, tomorrow. I can't conceive of, I mean, and Darfur is bad enough, but let's just go to the extreme and go to Rwanda. There is no Rwanda that I can imagine in any country that would convince Russia, China, and the United States to agree on a response. Maybe I'm overly cynical here, but if that's the case, and that's a humanitarian issue, it's hard to do a thought experiment about what Iran, let's say Iran had everything that the Bush administration once thought it had. It's hard to do a thought experiment and imagine Russia, China, and the United States agreeing on a set of containment measures or rollback measures, not military, but, you know, other forms of really aggressive sanctions that might convince Ahmadinejad to curtail his probe. If that's the case on both security and humanitarian issues, then I think you're going to see countries and citizens who have an interest in those issues moving away from that part of the UN. That doesn't mean that the Sergio part becomes obsolete or irrelevant, that the humanitarian part, you know, it still becomes the place that you go to each of the ambassadors and get the little bit of their national interest. It still becomes the only global body where all countries are present if you want to deal with threats that are, there are challenges that exist in all countries. So there's still going to be a functionality for the UN, but on that critical issue of peace and security and how to respond, I think you're going to see other structures arising.
Terry, we have time actually just barely for one more question.
Better be at the back. Yes, sir. Okay. Yep.
All right, thank you. I just want to testify to the good works of Ms. Power. A couple of years ago, you were going to interview Madeleine Albright at the Festival of Books.
The worst interview, not the interview itself was fine, but the response I got was, it was as if I had committed grand larceny or homicide on that panel.
Maybe I'm partially responsible because I emailed you back in Cambridge to...
Were you one of those mean emailers who told me...
No, I wasn't. I just said, I want you to hold her accountable.
Well, that's what they were mad at me for. That was my first window into why Hillary Clinton was going to be a major political force was... Was the perception? Sorry to interrupt.
But tell us what actually
happened. It was literally one of the worst days of my life.
Well, all right, let's just finish. I asked you to hold her accountable for her what I felt was abominable role,
right?
Not in the U.S. not responding to the crisis in Rwanda,
right?
And that she should be held accountable.
Yeah, it's your fault.
And
that,
by heaven,
that day was my. It's 100% your fault. Yeah,
and you did it, and I appreciate that.
You alone.
But
you and me alone.
The other thing is, I would like you to consider, I know you're both genocided out and all, but in terms of a film project, keep in mind the words Roger Casement.
Great.
I'll pass that on to Jim Sheridan. And
the pitch is, of course, Brokeback Mountain meets Heart of Darkness.
Yeah,
that's
okay,
how you
yeah.
pitch it.
I can go in. I'm really going to try and sell that one tomorrow.
All right,
thank Fox.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I will, yeah. Thanks.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.